De l'âge.
De l'âge, ok. Welcome to the center, and sorry for the inconvenience. I should have given you the exact...
It's my fault, actually.
...set of route map or something. But welcome, formally, and so welcome those of you who are here. Let me just, I think since it's a small group, it's going to be, you could present in an informal way, or if you want to read the paper as you wish, because it's a smaller group, so you can engage in a discussion. And that's Rembert. He's a doctoral student, Sanskrit and Kavya and Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, and so on. And that's, what's her name? Anna Joy. She's an undergraduate student, and she comes here for lectures on Hinduism. And this is Professor Nair from Kerala, University of Kerala, and he's a Sanskritist up there, and he is now visiting fellow for this term. He's actually on his way out on Sunday.
Okay.
So this is his last kind of thing. And I'm Pratap Kumar, I'm the academic director of the center. I don't know if you got to correspond with Shanaka Rishi. He is the executive director of the center. So he may kind of visit in the middle of somewhere, but you probably will get a chance to meet him. So it's a the center is basically independent of the university, and the students of the university come here to interact, to use the resources and so on. So
that's why I found difficulties to locate it, because it was not registered. And
So that's one disadvantage, because we should be more known than we are, but we are kind of trying. So that's the thing. And Remy Delage is speaking today on pilgrimage as a geographic ritual in South Indian Hinduism, mainly focusing on Sabarimala Ayyappan tradition. So it's over to you.
So I will present it a bit in more formal way, but
it's up to you.
Just because of my English.
Yeah.
But if you want to interfere in the middle, I don't mind. So before starting, it is it might be useful to give you a sketch of the background of the Sabarimala phenomenon in contemporary South India, for those who don't know about it. So the pilgrimage to Sabarimala is one of the most significant phenomenon in religious phenomenon in the contemporary period. It attracts several million pilgrims to its site in a mountainous region of South Central Kerala. You can refer to the map for those who are not familiar with it. And it is happening during a 2.5 month season, structured around the cult of Ayyappa, who is an ambivalent deity who emerged from a marriage between Vishnu and Shiva. This pilgrimage presents original geographical and anthropological characteristics. That it attracts essentially a population originating from the south, from the four southern states of India. And the deity's territory is well structured through a hierarchy-sized network of sacred places in Kerala. From an anthropological point of view, the pilgrimage to Sabarimala is distinguished by its ritual initiation ceremony to the cult, the Malapuja, as well as its essentially male-dominated attendance, justified by the preservation of the ritual purity of the site. Pubescent women are excluded from the pilgrimage. And also through the period of austerity, the Vratam period, of 41 to 61 days, during which I observed some interesting disruption of domestic and village territoriality. On a sociological level, the promotion and diffusion of a message of equality, openness to all levels of society, and any religious affiliations, reinforces the unique character of this pilgrimage. This latter feature has been confirmed also by a large-scale survey, showing its heterogeneous sociological profile, integrating lower classes as well as a higher stratum of society. Besides, a cartography of geographical origins shows similar proportion of urban and rural pilgrims, placing the how maps of Sabarimala at odds with general representation of Indian pilgrimage. So I begin this presentation about the pilgrimage by exposing the major trends of the sociological debate around Sabarimala. The sociological analysis of pilgrimage calls for a deeper analysis of individuals, groups, and communities. The fieldwork activity enabled me to show also that the circulatory logic of pilgrimage wasn't individual but a collective one. This fact, which is easily observable, led me to the well-known concept of communitas developed by the anthropologist Victor Turner. Even though many authors criticize the Turner's work when applied to the Indian context, the concept of communitas matches well with the case study of Sabarimala pilgrimage, not only because of the collective dimension of traveling, but also because the pilgrims dissociate themselves from the structural constraints of social day-to-day life, which temporarily inscribes a person in a group hierarchized by the criteria of renunciation, before being reincorporated in the social whole with a relative changes in status. So the communitas, the concept of communitas, refers to an anti-structure characterized by homogeneity, social equality, and opposed to the ordinary structure of day-to-day life existence defined by social heterogeneity, caste hierarchy, and status inequality. For Victor Turner, there are three types of communitas: the existential and spontaneous one. The second is a normative communitas derived from the first one. And the third is the ideological communitas, grounded on the existential one. So which type of communitas corresponds closest to the Sabarimala case? I think the ideological one, since for Turner, the ideological communitas is, I quote, is at once an attempt to describe the external and visible effects, the outward form, it might be said, of an inward experience of existential communitas, and to spell out the optimal social condition under which such experiences might be expected to flourish and multiply. The annual repetition of pilgrimages like Sabarimala can be related to an ideology founding communitas by proposing equality and unity among all pilgrims during the public event. During these 2.5 months season from mid-November to the end of January month, The sociological model proposed by the temporary community of pilgrims is one based on utopias erected as a counter model, how to live together in a country fragmented by interreligious clashes and riots. So the case study of Sabarimala is at counter current from other pilgrimages where the concept of communitas is applicable. In some, most pilgrimages offer a temporal and spatial frame favoring the reproduction of caste hierarchy and only occasionally emancipating from it. However, the equality and unity claimed by all the actors of the pilgrimage to Sabarimala works only among men. The gender inequality is still observed during the pilgrimage. So Sabarimala is a pilgrimage, is an inversion, kind of inversion of all other Hindu pilgrimage cases in India, to my opinion. So what is the hierarchy and the terminology of status stratification among the pilgrims group? The term used to qualify the group, the team, as South Indian men say, reveals that the Sabarimala pilgrimage is conceived as a test, how to endure the hardship of the trip. They go in groups in order to support each other while facing hardship of the route, physical pain and tiredness, as well as maintaining a high level of piety together. The necessity of going in group recalls the ancient practice of pilgrimage, when there were no facilities, accommodation, or travel and medical assistance, and the route wasn't populated with wild animals. So it is not surprising that the main criteria of structuring the pilgrims group refer to the number of experienced pilgrims. Age is not a criteria, whereas experience is, that is, the number of participation to the pilgrimage. So at the top of the hierarchy is a Guru Swami, that is the spiritual guide and teacher of the group, who has participated in the pilgrimage at least for 18 times, consecutively or not. Apart from his knowledge about mythic corpus and devotional songs, he is also the experienced man in charge of managing all ritual activities. He must also have the geographical knowledge of the route and its dangers. He only decides about the complex itinerary of pilgrimage before reaching the village of Erumeli, which is a major transit point at the departure place for reaching Sabarimala by the traditional forest route, the 48-mile route. Paraphrasing Guru Swami as a passeur, that is, like those operating in the transnational migrant labor networks, we could go further while stating that there exists a merchant relation between him and the pilgrims. The people critical of Sabarimala pilgrimage used to say that the Guru Swami attracts as many pilgrims as possible only to earn more money. But apart from this practice of consumption, the Guru Swami must also assess the physical condition of the pilgrims before departure, inform them about the difficulty of the trek, and controlling the number of pilgrims at different stages of the pilgrimage. Now, the lowest status of the hierarchy is that of the Kani Swami, literally virgin or beginner. For his first participation to the pilgrimage, he has to fulfill the ritual obligation of dancing in the village of Erumeli. This dance is famous and is called the Petatulal in Malayalam. Under the guidance of this Guru Swami, the Kani Swami, the beginner in the pilgrimage, is supposed to arrange a modest feast, Lahu, for the pilgrims of his group before starting the pilgrimage, and again just before filling and packing ritual bundles which will be carried on the top of their heads all along the route until the final blessing is received. Once the group has reached the sacred Pampa River, which is located 4 kilometers at the bottom of the hill of Sabari, the Kani Swami has to perform again yet another feast on the banks, the Pampa Sadhya. Then the Randam Swami and the Munam Swami are titles for pilgrims referring respectively to the second Kani and third Kani. From fourth rank, there are no vernacular terms to distinguish pilgrims from a hierarchical point of view. However, the duty of each pilgrim differs according to the rank. For instance, the Kani Swami is always under the supervision of the Guru Swami, whereas the Randam Swami, the second time pilgrim, assists the latter for cooking as well as for the ritual preparations. The second Kani is confined to the internal sphere of the group, informed strictly here by material and ritual aspects of the pilgrimage. The second rank pilgrim have to bring along a small sword, the churika, that will be deposited in Sabarimala, whereas the third rank ones, who are not supposed to move outside the base camp, bring a bell, money, for the same purpose. This hierarchy is, however, relatively flexible compared to the caste hierarchy and social status. These principles have been elaborated in the context of that devotion favoring the annual repetition of pilgrimage practice. Hence, the size of participation and the number of participation is a criteria of internal hierarchy. So I'll turn now to the pilgrimage and the reproduction of masculine domination. As all women going to Sabarimala who are younger than 12 and above 50 are called Malikapuram. They are confined to the domestic and material activities of the group, such as cooking and washing dishes, and are supervised by men, lest they disturb other pilgrims by their presence. Sabarimala pilgrimage is largely dominated by male attendants, while other pilgrimages, and especially other sites of Ayyappa cult, whether it be in Kerala or South India, are not. As the physical limit between men and women is restricted, gender relationships can be read out at the sociological scale of the pilgrimage, as well as at the domestic scale during the period of austerities preceding the departure to Sabarimala. So men do not sleep inside the house, but outside in the veranda or sometimes in the local temple, where penitent pilgrims used to gather for singing devotional songs. This gender division reflects also an opposition or dialectical complementarity between the Hindu figure of householder and the one of renouncer. Caroline Osella and Philip Osella, two anthropologists, English anthropologists, showed in a recent article how the hyper-masculine deity Ayappa participated to the enhancement and reproduction of male identity of Kerala and South Indian men. The pilgrimage practice shows two forms of interaction between men and the deity, and between the pilgrim and the masculine community. I quote them. If Sabarimala remasculinizes men and male deities via immersion into an imaginary and differentiated body of men, it does so by reaffirming a gender hierarchy through the exclusion of women, on whom men otherwise depend in their everyday lives. So the ascetic practice before starting the pilgrimage of chastity, piety, and vegetarianism, the physical difficulties throughout the trek, and the nearly continuous immersion of the pilgrims with Ayappa from their home domestic space all the way up to Sabarimala, contribute to the general process of identification of these pilgrims with a society dominated by men. If we take further the argument of the two authors, the general interest of South Indian men for the practice of this pilgrimage could be a collective response to the weakening of men power over women in a contemporary reshaping social relations in India. Sabarimala is a model of is a kind of model of female exclusion, a model that satisfies millions of South Indian men. What is more, equality and undifferentiation of status experiences between men during the pilgrimage are permitted by the reactivation of hierarchical relations of domination and subordination between men and women, without which the masculine communitas could not exist. The masculine representations of men-women relations are reactivated also periodically during the astrological report, the Deva Prasnam, in the temple, reflecting the significance of secular power of men over the ambivalent power of the deity. They are also exacerbated during the pilgrimage time. Using Victor Turner's vocabulary, pilgrimage could not be conceived here in terms of a ritual of status inversion, but rather as a rite of elevation of the hierarchical position of men in the society. Sorry. So the sociological structure of pilgrimage in terms of gender relationship is more than the simple reflection of Indian society. It is the paroxysm revealing internal contradiction of pilgrimage, that is equality of men and gender bias, while disclosing to the entire public the existence of an encompassing project through which gender discrimination is legitimized by religious ideals. To sum up, I contend that a gender approach will always prefer the analysis to one or the other text of a social group or community. Bourdieu demonstrated that women maintain and reproduce often unconsciously representations of inferiority in comparison with masculine superiority. This process leads to what he calls the reproduction of masculine domination. Even though the simultaneous analysis of representations and practices, either masculine or feminine, enables us to size up the hierarchical stakes of power relationships, the gender approach is only one key of interpretation among others. The popularity today of Sabarimala pilgrimage should not be limited to its gender bias. So before turning to the core of my argument, as mentioned in that summary, I will just give few sociological details about who is going to Sabarimala exactly. So any deep sociological and geographical analysis of such a widespread pilgrimage should necessarily use a wide-scale survey by questionnaire in order to get precise figure on the pilgrimage to know exactly who is coming. There are several discourses about the sociological profile of the pilgrimage, but there have been never been surveys of qualitative survey to know, or quantitative in this case, to know exactly what happens. So Our survey, which was prepared in the six languages commonly spoken at Sabarimala and diffused toward about 900 pilgrims, required a whole crew of researchers originating from all the four southern states of India. It was conducted during the season 2001-2002 in the village of Eromeli, not far from Sabarimala. So briefly, the survey analysis showed that in South India, pilgrims of all origins are indeed going to Sabarimala. Here I quote an article in The Hindu, dated from 1992. The author saying that, I quote, "A silent and unnoticed religious fervor has been sweeping the southern states in the last 2 or 3 years. In numerous towns and villages, hundreds of boys are joining, thousands of them elder menfolk, in donning the black garb indicative of the Ayyappa Bhakta. From street hawkers to auto drivers, bus conductors to salaried employees, skilled artisans to professionals, irrespective of wealth and or riches, the Ayyappa fever seems to have infected everyone." So the assertion is true, but requires a few more sociological details. About 60 to 65% of the pilgrims in each state are aged between 20 and 40 years old, while little boys and girls as well, older men and women until 80 years old, used to go to Sabarimala. The high representation of bachelors, representing one-third of the population there, corresponds also to the ritual prerequisite of the pilgrimage, wherein the deity is depicted as a renouncer, and the pilgrims are mostly men and boys. Caroline and Filippo Sella, the two anthropologists I mentioned before, stated that the contemporary pilgrimage reinforces the process of masculinization through the exacerbated opposition between the figure of renouncer and the one of householder. But returning to the sociological profile, there is an expected level of literacy among the pilgrims' population, contrary to some common representation by which the pilgrimage would be only attracting illiterate people, rural people. Then, if the most Tamil pilgrim surveyed are involved in agricultural activities, pilgrims from elsewhere in South India, from Karnataka, Kerala, and Andhra Pradesh, are working in non-agricultural fields. I will turn on now to the motivation also to participate to the pilgrimage. And these data are not only based on my quantitative survey, but in qualitative field work with interviews. So the individual and collective dimension of pilgrim practices are interconnected, as the motivation to participate to the pilgrimage is based upon a one-to-one relation with the divine. The religious value of merit, the one of punyam, which defines the practice of several Indian pilgrimages, is replaced in Sabarimala by the category of vows and thanks to the deity. The prevailing reason is obviously of social origin, in the sense that the pilgrims' goal in going to Sabarimala is mainly to see their problems of economical survival of their household, of biological reproduction, of bodily diseases, and so on, solved by the blessing of Ayyappa, its darshan. In this regard, Sabarimala pilgrimage is well embodied in modern Hinduism, as it is rather animated by devotion, by bhaktis, and by search of release, moksha, from the cycle of birth and death, which is a feature of an elitist practice of Hinduism and different from Sabarimala. So to sum up, the values of renunciation concern the practice of the pilgrimage group during the period of austerities, the Vratam period, and the individual motivations are more concerned with devotion. So one of the major hypotheses now considering pilgrimage as a geographical ritual could be analyzed in terms of successive crossings from one state of spatial and temporal consciousness to another state. The route, the mountain, and the walk play as an attractive set in the structuring and reproduction of a spatial imaginary of pilgrimage. That is the reason why I paid particular attention also during my fieldwork activities to the relations between the pilgrim's body and the surrounding space, the pain experienced in walking the forest route before reaching Sabarimala, as well as the various levels of geographical consciousness according to the places crossed and the intensity of devotion. Posing the question of how the group territorialize the space, occupy it, and make it their own in the context of religious mobility, help me to verify the hypothesis of pilgrimage as a pretext for recreating an original link with the earth, as well as all the pilgrims go barefoot. This is the Padayatra. So this practice leads to the redefinition of the first level of geographical identity, that is territoriality. The difficulty of religious travel experienced by the pilgrims produces sometimes social consideration from non-pilgrims because of the hazards of the route. So pilgrimage becomes a major factor, the hardship of the route becomes a major factor in deciding to go to Sabarimala, as well as the form of learning geographical and cultural distinction. So in this debate, there are several theories about the issue of respective transformations of the geographical consciousness of an individual in the context of pilgrimage. So are we applying to the Indian context of pilgrimage the model of spatial re-archization based on the dichotomy sacred and profane as Christian culture? In other words, the closer in the Western context, the closer we are close to the pilgrimage center, the higher the emotional tension. Each stage or place of the route intensifying gradually the religious experience. Some anthropologists, like the French one, Jean-Claude Gallet, thinks the time has come to break free from such Christian egocentric view. Unlike to the Christian pilgrim, a Hindu achieves a similar experience of totality at each place of the route, each locality of pilgrimage site being the expression of universalism. Yet, the value of steadfastness, relevant in all Indian pilgrimage sites, supposedly replicates of normative models that are uniquely and invariably experienced by pilgrims with the same attitude. The stages of the itinerary between residency and Sabarimala matter as much as the destination. This model seems to apply to the exterior stage of the pilgrimage between one's own residency and the village of Eromeli, a route marked out by regional religious centers. However, the village of Eromeli opens the gate to an internal route, a territory placed under the rule and sovereignty of Ayyappa. The walk through the forest route leaves the pilgrims in a state of excitation and frenzy, an emotional tension growing as they get closer to the village of Pampa at the bottom of the hill of Sabari. Day and night, this gradation of intensity could be heard through devotional songs and the spelling of ritual formulas all along the way. As the anthropologist Valentin Daniel puts in his phenomenological approach of Sabarimala pilgrimage, the religious construction of emotion and devotion, as well as the identification process with the deity, operates by levels of intensity. He distinguishes between the constraints of the forest trek, which prevent one from identifying with the deity, and whereas the approach to the temple premises, especially when climbing the 18 steps of the temple before queuing and waiting for the darshan, is a privileged moment for establishing a direct relationship with the divine. The separation between the domestic space and the immersion within Ayyappa, however, starts as soon as the period of austerities begin, that is 40 to 61 days before departing to Sabarimala. The two reading grids, or the two models presented above, coexist in the case study of Sabarimala. Although similar at the topographical level, some of the Himalayan pilgrimages to the Ganges don't show moments of expression of the religious feeling which I observed during Sabarimala pilgrimage, at least at the verbal level. In Sabarimala, the devotional intensity reaches its paroxysm when pilgrims climb the 18 steps of the temple. In some way, we could say that each step also symbolizes a mountain or an intermediary deity, and by hypothesis, the steps symbolizes also all the previous stages of the voyage, which are moments of mental disposition at the spiritual level. So the darshan of the deity is then the awaited moment, as it is an experience of non-verbal exchanges during which transfer of substances and energies are in operation. This is also a moment which the divine grace of Ayyappa enables purification and realization of the pilgrim's vows. The pilgrims start their pilgrimage from their residency during the period of austerities. I observed significant disruptions of domestic territoriality. The house map is changed by the obligation for male participants to sleep outside, and the food restrictions induce also restriction of access to the kitchen. When the pilgrims have enough financial resources, they organize a ceremony called Ayyappan Vilakku, during which all the group members are gathered before departing on pilgrimage, mostly by bus. This means of transport becomes then a living space where pilgrims spend a lot of time for sleeping, watching the sceneries, listening to devotional songs, chatting, etc. This place is well structured. The Guru Swami in the front of the bus and few others who make sure that the itinerary chosen by the team includes halls for eating and sleeping is strictly respected by the driver. The voyage progresses at a frenetic rhythm, as time should not be wasted. The pilgrims stop many times a day for half an hour or 1 hour maximum when visiting temple. On the way back, in a devotional atmosphere and excitement aroused by the memories of a previous participation to the pilgrimage or the special representation about landscapes to be discovered, they pass more or less out of phase with the reality. Each beginner daydreams listening to worn-out old stories of pilgrimage related by friends or relatives who praise the merit won through such an experience or the sensitive pleasure of discovering new places and people. Contrary to the pilgrims on foot from their home residency to Sabarimala, this is the case of some Tamil pilgrims, for example, from Madurai, who undertake the pilgrimage barefoot from Tamil Nadu to Sabarimala. The ordinary motorized pilgrims are concerned also by number of places and can try to visit in a short period so as to make the individual cost of the pilgrimage cheaper. In such case, there is not much time for eating, and sleeping is often uncomfortable conditions in the bath or outdoors by the roadside or in temples. The experience of crossing the Western Ghats is also a stimulating new experience that enables imaginary and religious feeling to be displayed and deployed at the altitude of mountain as a whole powerful influence on pilgrimage practice. Pilgrims head to evergreen mountains covered by dense forest and populated with wild animals. They represent this is not really true. I mean, this is part of the representation of the pilgrimage, considering that the route is still marked by dangers and wild animals and etc. etc. It is also an attractive factor still today for pilgrims to go to Sabarimala. Pilgrims heads to during the winter season, the village of Kumili at the border between Kerala and Tamil Nadu, just north of Sabarimala, shows a particular atmosphere as it is at the same time a major and busy transit point for Tamil pilgrims and a tourist spot. The behavior of pilgrims dressed with black clothes. Tourists from foreign countries with their own colored dress and North Indian tourists from middle classes are also in sharply contrasted by their respective gender relationships. The social and cultural mixing process can be observed in all tourist spots of Kerala during the pilgrimage season. This hybrid period may coincide also with the Hajj pilgrimage around Christmas. In the village of Erumeli, pilgrims witnesses interreligious harmony when at the end of December month, as a Christmas season, gives way to a Muslim procession of Chandanakulam, during which pilgrims, other Hindus and some Christians, may also join the cortege. So such an atmosphere in the state of Kerala during 2.5 months is that into which the pilgrims inscribe themselves temporarily. Each place crossed becomes an area shared by pilgrims groups of different origin, and this is also the case of places of rest that mark the forest route and the walking phase of the pilgrimage. The ephemeral camps are the occasion to meet people with a distinct linguistic and cultural background, but with a common religious affiliation to Hinduism. The tents and sheds that are temporarily set up give a good examples of such nodes, in which the pilgrims exchange their own experience of the social space, retell about daily events, share a special information while carrying the stories of the place, of the places through which they have passed. The spatial temporality of pilgrimage looks like also the one of everyday life, which does not last, but during which each pilgrim develops habits, familiarizing himself with a new environment. In the village of Pampa, it is hard to clear one's way on the path, as it is to find a place to spend overnight, eat and sleep. Mutual aid between pilgrims is frequent during time of rest and walk, and the pattern of living characterizing the Sabarimala pilgrimage is about which values are highly sought after by the pilgrims. Values of simplicity, good manners, discover of nature, harmony between individuals and religious confessions, equality in front of God and man. The experience of pilgrimage space is an indicator of the way everybody manages his own social link with other pilgrims in a context wherein societal difference is theoretically abolished. The experience is all the more intense that the pilgrimage is, to my opinion, the only one providing such a union between pilgrims belonging to different castes, profession classes and cultural backgrounds. The pilgrimage unites all the participants in a common goal, the darshan of Ayyappa. All the places of rest and exchange wherein all sorts of pilgrims pass each other are nodes of interculturality, though the degree of interaction varies according to individuals. So the pilgrims' groups share free space, whether it be a shared or an open-air portion of land. The layout of places reflects an image of a territory appropriated by the pilgrims. We can imagine the form of such a territory as a small-scale model of South Indian cultural regionalism. Under the same shed live together four main cultural groups, the Telugu, Tamil, Kannada and Malayali. But is such cohabitation sufficient to speak about interculturality? Is there really interaction between individuals or only co-presence of distinct cultural entities, each one being marginalized in its own portion of space? Obviously, the frontier of language must be taken into account. It is easier only for the middle classes pilgrims participating to the to the pilgrimage to communicate in English and cross the linguistic boundaries. So, the question: can the territoriality of pilgrim groups be conceived as a reproduction of the South Indian cultural map? We could decide that the hybrid composition of pilgrimage is a mirage, a state towards which a society can project itself without attaining it. Then it would be legitimate to argue that the pilgrimage, as other pilgrimages in India, propose a unique model of cohabitation between different cultural groups, and that the diversity tends towards the invention of social forms of internal and external cohesion that reinforcing identity and neighborhood. At a comparative level, it is interesting to note that in great Hindu pilgrimage places in North India, such as Ayodhya, Varanasi or Himalayan pilgrimage, the facilities for resting and catering for pilgrims mentioned of Indian states such as Bengal, veg restaurant, Uttar Pradesh or Rajasthan Lodge, etc. The anthropologist Peter van der Veer showed in its analysis of Ayodhya pilgrimage center how networks of low-caste priests, the Pandas, were connected until the 19th century to patrons in a relation of clientelism or royal elites. During the 20th century, these patrons had been replaced by agents in charge of recruiting pilgrims straight at their residency and to bring them over in pilgrimage and to put them in touch with these priests and thus to get income. These agents would deform little by little the traditional organization of pilgrimage in North India at the socio-professional level, are also linked with patrons of hotels and transport services. They capture pilgrims as soon as they reach the railway station and take care of their all rituals and lodging requirements. These agents maintain the idea of cultural preference for lodging. To my knowledge, such a division of space according to geographical and linguistic differences does not exist in South India or in the case study of Sabarimala pilgrimage. Hence the question, does the Sabarimala pilgrims construction of cultural identity differ from North to South India? The comparison between Sabarimala, where difference is abolished in the socio-spatial system that enables simultaneously identity and neighborhood, and for instance the pilgrimage site of Badrinath, when cultural difference is publicly posted as a criteria of identity, leads me to answer yes. Identities are more pronounced in the north than in the south, where they appear much more fluid. It is at this particular level of analysis that the heuristic value of territoriality concept must be located. The comparative analysis of pilgrimage territoriality reveals the modernity of a somewhat South Indian conception of identity. However, the religious ideology that underpins the Sabarimala pilgrimage does not hide a desire of the temple authority to promote such a cultural unity to the national territory, even if today it is clearly confined to the South Indian space. Thank you.
I think before we go into discussion, if there are any preliminary questions to ask you any clarification or whatever.
You mentioned that there are these different kinds of people who go on pilgrimage. There was the one who went 18 times.
Yeah.
Guru Swami.
Okay. He's like the founder of Dhaka person? Or?
You're very familiar with that.
Yeah, one who has gone to Sabarimala for 18 times, he will be declared. He will be considered by others as a Guru Swami and called
by the name, addressed by the name Guru Swami. The title is a guru teacher and the spiritual guide.
So he can come from any social background.
From any social background, and if you want to participate in the pilgrimage to Sabarimala, you have to approach one Guru Swami, and you have to be trained by through a ceremony, to a ceremony initiation to the cult, which is called the Mala Puja. After that, you are enrolled in the group, and you have to follow the instructions and.
So if you've done it once, then.
For 18 times at least, you have to be under the guidance of Guru Swami. And
would that be always the same person, or you can
choose? Oh, you can move from one group to another if you want, but usually they used to go. One of the specific feature of this pilgrimage is pilgrims are going to Sabarimala year after year. In mostly in North India, they're going to Badrinath once. They are not going for 15 times, 20 times, or 50 times. Sabarimala, they are going for 50 times. I met some South Indian women.
So, who confers this rank on this individual who completes 18 times, and how would they verify this? I mean,
Yeah, actually no such verification. Nobody confers. He is considered by the people in the locality as a Guru Swami.
So how would they know? Like say,
word of mouth. In the neighborhood only will accept him as a Guru Swami. Guru Swamis are available in plenty.
Yeah.
So no problem. There is no confrontation. And also, even
there is no kind of a hierarchical structure.
Nothing. And also, as he put it, this happens, but it is not necessary that you should do these things under the nothing of the sort.
Mm.
If you have this particular kind of vradam for 41 days, and if you have got this irumudi,
yeah.
Of course you can go. Nobody will question you. When you go to Sabarimala, whether you have performed this 41 days vratam, this also is not going to be verified. But you should have this irumudi, which
is a ritual bundle you are carrying on the top of your head.
Yeah, that's right.
This like authoritative position, is that only during the pilgrimage or like the rest of the year? Does he have some special status during the rest? I mean, is he like a spiritual guide?
No. During the time of the pilgrimage only.
Because the Guru Swami will be sometimes a judge.
It will be never addressed. It will never be addressed as such apart from the pilgrimage period.
In fact, what I noticed was, I don't know if it has to do with 18 times or even one time. Those who return from the pilgrimage, when they come back to their home base, at least during that initial period, I don't know how long it lasts, but they are considered like sacred. In fact, people prostrate before them, you know, when they are received in their hometowns or villages and so on. People prostrate almost to the extent of like he is now the embodiment of the divine, as it were, walking in, and there is a lot of reverence and
maybe more on the way back, but also on the way too, they are considered as Ayyappan.
Yeah.
So if they are going barefoot from, for instance, from Madurai to Sabarimala, there are several pilgrims going from Madurai to Sabarimala by walk, and they are considered as.
What I also noticed was.
Yeah.
Can I just say thank you so much?
Yeah.
I have to go because I have another class, but thank you very much. It's really interesting.
Thanks.
Yeah, you did not make any mention about Vavar.
No.
Why?
Me? Why I didn't mention?
Yeah.
Because yes, I omitted to raise several topics, even controversial topics of Sabarimala pilgrimage.
You see, in this it occupies a very important position. You see, the secular aspect of Sabarimala pilgrimage, as far as I view it, is to be taken into account in the prime position. And you see, we have a great singer who has won President's Medal, Yeshudas.
Yeah.
Malayalam singer.
Who is Christian.
He has no entry to the Guruvayur temple. You see, Guruvayur temple is the most famous temple of Kerala. He has no entry there. Whereas he used to go
to Sabarimala.
There he has no...
there is no caste operation.
Caste, early, nothing.
Yeah,
of the sort.
Yeah.
One who has this 41 days vratam, he can go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this, and also, you see, in near vicinity of Sabarimala Ayyappan, there is this Vavar Swami, who is actually a Muslim. Vavar is a Muslim. So the pilgrims who go to Sabarimala, first, you see, have this pilgrimage to Vavar, then they go to Ayyappan.
Mm.
It's a very notable point.
Yeah.
He's a Muslim.
Especially in the village of Erumeli, where you have a mosque dedicated, to Vavar.
Vavar.
The pilgrims, they're either kind of, not unusual in India, but a procession between Ayyappa temple, Vavar Mosque, another Ayyappa temple, and after that they are going through the forest route. Apart from that, I would like to say that this Sabarimala pilgrimage contains many contradictions. That's why there are such procession, including the mosque Muslim figures, and you have this ongoing discourse, secular discourse about Sabarimala pilgrimage, open to all religious and social affiliations, but in practice it is a Hindu pilgrimage.
But the thing is, at the moment when you look at it, of course it is a Hindu pilgrimage, but it never started as such. It was a secular pilgrimage, and it has several influences also. For example, the Muslims from Kerala go to Mecca. They have the Hajj pilgrimage, and for this purpose, the government as Chakkar itself pays a bit of amount, and they have a Wakaf board from which they can get subsidized flights are also even there. So this also has influenced the rise in the number of pilgrims going to the and for this nobody has any agency or any such board to help them in this matter. Similarly, the Christians also have developed this sort of pilgrimage centers. For example, the Perumalapalli, or otherwise we can Malayattu. So originally it was a center, not a Hindu center. Later it was Hinduized, and the Hinduization process is going on. For example, in this abode of Lord Ayyappa also, now the puja, etc., are performed by a tantri. And actually speaking, this tantra has nothing to do with this Ayyappa. Because we in Kerala follow Tantra Samuchaya. Tantra Samuchaya by Chanas Nambudiri, which includes in itself all the details of the performances of pujas, etc., of the different temples of Kerala, but excluding Ayyappa, because Ayyappa does not come into that picture.
In the
Tantra Samuchaya. And this Tantri, who is an authority of Tantra, what has he got to do in this abode of Ayyappa?
This is an hereditary family originated from a village nearby Chengano, I think, who is in charge of the temple rituals for the last 100 or 200 years, I don't know. And that's why this pilgrimage and this cult has been indeed Sanskritized and taken over by these tantris. It was supposed to be a local pilgrimage and with a local attendance or regional attendance, and then it has been Brahmanized, Sanskritized, and
those are details pertaining to it. But when you people, especially from outside, give an explanation or give a present a picture of this sort, of course, my humble request is to avoid this aspect, namely Vava.
One response to that, and then I want to add another complication to what you brought. I think there are several instances where pilgrimages the yatras. The popular jatra and so on, about the non-Brahmanical kind of movements. There are several instances where they emanated in the context of a kind of a combination between Hindu-Muslim kind of thing. Like Shirdi, Sai in the north is one example. So in that sense, I think it's not entirely unreasonable to kind of consider that as a non-Hindu, because it may have had other kind of elements that it has brought in, but it certainly seems to locate itself in a predominantly Hindu kind of mythology. And here, what you brought up early on in your talk, the reference to the marriage between Shiva and Vishnu, and then your connection with the Tantra. In Kanchivaram, I think it's the Parakalsami temple, on the western gate, there is a whole depiction of the Tantra Buddhist kind of images. And there actually, if I'm not mistaken, if my memory serves right, there is this image, the depiction of Shiva chasing Vishnu. You remember that episode where Vishnu takes the form of Mohini. You know,
this is the same myth for Savarimala.
Exactly. So, and then Mohini is serving this nectar to these gods and then avoiding the demons and so on. And then at the end of that, Shiva mistakes Mohini, and then he falls in love, and then he chases Mohini, and then at that end, Vishnu appears. Of course, by then they already had intercourse. And then there is this connection now. Whether that connection can be taken right up to Shanmugan in the south, the Subrahmanya, the, you know, all these connections, you know, the what is it, the Murukan.
There are connections actually at the mythological level.
Yeah, there are a whole lot of connections here.
That have taken
but
over several.
Yeah, but as regards Shabdi Malay, you see, there are several other points too.
Yeah.
You see, these mythologies are more ancient than Ayyappa.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, the origin of Ayyappa is related with Pandalam Dajas. Ayyappa is considered to be a son of Pandalam Daja.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, he was a man. It was later that he was elevated to the position of... and we have to take into account conflicts among the Chera, Chola, and Pandya kingdoms also into account. Because, and it is said, you see, this Ayyappan was the chieftain or the chief of the army of this Pandalam Daja.
Mm.
And this Vava was his, you see, right hand.
Mm.
And that was, and in in the conflict, of course, you see, the Pandyans were defeated. And you see, the Pandalam royal region extended up to, you see, after this Malay, of course, it is Tamil Nadu.
Right.
So he was placed there as the protector of the land, and his right hand was this Vava. That was why he also started to be worshipped. So Ayyappan and Vava. My point is, I have not made any specific study of these mythologies, etc. But this Vava, this, because you see, the actually speaking, there was another small temple for Vava also, which probably in the future may create some communal problems, therefore, which was already
taken away.
Yeah.
I think it certainly is a new phenomenon. I think it's picked up its momentum certainly in the mid or late 60s.
Yeah.
Then 70s it started to kind of spread throughout other
South India.
Yeah.
South Indian states. But now it's going right up to north.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the fastest growing pilgrimage kind of phenomenon. One interesting thing is there are a bunch of noisy people during that whole period.
Yeah.
They just carry
everywhere,
on.
Everywhere, yeah.
You know, during that whole phase, you won't get sleep.
We cannot travel in Kerala.
All the bones are seen, yeah.
And they actually are very aggressive travelers. When
yeah.
they are in the trains, they take over the
yeah.
compartment. And they no one else can get in. And they're very...
And they eat, they cook, then...
Yeah. What about the class and economic status? Is in your questionnaire, did you include any reference to it?
Yeah, I did include. I didn't.
Where are they coming from? I mean, from what I have seen, mainly they seem to be a kind of a lower economic strata.
But
but it may not have much indication as to which cost or whatever. There could be any cost.
The cost was a big problem during my questionnaire survey because I have collected so many, more than 100 caste names.
Mm.
About one third of it I couldn't identify at all.
Yeah.
And then I gave up.
The caste analysis.
Yeah, the caste analysis.
Yeah.
I still have my database and I'm still working on it. Yeah. But the thing is I have to approach different specialists from Karnataka and Tamil Nadu and Andhra Pradesh and
yeah.
Kerala to get a precise figure of what I got. I didn't do it yet, but...
The economic
outside Kerala, yeah, economic aspect, yeah, no, but this also, actually, there in Kerala, that was why I was telling you, even Marxists go to Sabarimala temple, because they are Marxist party members, because, at the same time, they are believers, they worship Ayyappa, so they go, they take this vrata and perform this vrata and go. And similarly, this economic, that also is not so at the moment in Kerala. Because even people from the range of high court judges, they go.
Yeah.
I'm quite interested in this distinction that you draw, punya versus vrata.
Mm.
That in the case of many of the North Indian and other pilgrimages, there is this desire for punya.
Yeah.
And then they go.
And for moksha.
Yeah. And here it seems to be more of a vow that they take for any particular reason,
yeah.
either a bad financial problem or health or
yeah.
whatever. And it's the recovery of that is the goal.
Yeah. This is clearly the dominant category for Sabarimala and other South Indian pilgrimages as well.
So what's the ontological kind of status of pilgrimage in that sense here? Is there an ultimate goal for this pilgrimage, like in the case of any, say, other religious groups that go on pilgrimage to go to the Ganges to get punya or to go to a temple to become, you know, holy?
Actually, to my mind, to my opinion, there is no ultimate goal, such as in the North Indian pilgrimages. And after that, it depends also on... who is going to Sabarimala with what kind of background and knowledge about Hinduism? You can. I met several very knowledgeable pilgrims about Hinduism, and they are more going to Sabarimala with ultimate goal and bringing very higher concepts of Hinduism like moksha and all this. Things, but mostly ordinary people, they just go to thank the God for the vows which have been realized, and that's all.
I'm kind of trying to figure out this notion of vrata vis-a-vis this renunciation,
mm-hmm.
to renounce for that period
yeah.
at least. Everything that is material, you know, to kind of subordinate the body, inflict pain and you know, all of that, only to acquire that material goal that they wanted. Either it's a prosperity of business success or mental health or whatever it is. which seems to be kind of a sort of a reversal of turning upside down the Brahmanical notion of sannyasa, the vrata, and renunciation, you know, which is kind of what happens towards the last stage, where someone is kind of moving in that direction slowly from the, you know, the householder right up to there, and then that's the culmination of his kind of destiny.
Mm-mm-mm.
Whereas here, it kind of freezes a period of one's life, and then in that period, there is this intense, severe penance observed, not for purpose of any ultimate thing, but rather to recover
a
material kind of goal.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
And start...
Yeah,
but
then the process begins again. Next year he may do it again.
Yeah.
And so what? Then what about these guys who do 18 times? Well, why are they doing it? Is it because, let's say somebody in XYZ takes a vow this year for the first time and goes, and then let's say hypothetically his family is healed, you know, or there is some, you know, result, positive result. So he could stop, you know, next year from going because he got what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, what if he then goes?
Yeah.
So would that then
usually for the first or second time, this is the reason why they are going to Sabarimala, because they have been ill, or father or mother have been ill, then they have been to Sibaris, to they have been asking to Ayyappa for recovering and all these things. But the thing is, that's why I wanted to talk also today about this the pilgrimage conceived as a geographical ritual, because most of the people, why they go yearly to Sabarimala is because of the travel experience, which is very peculiar. I mean, from South India, it's not like going, you are in Delhi and you want to go to Badrinath, you go to Badrinath and you come back. For example, you take one pilgrims group or one persons from Vijayawada in Andhra Pradesh, and it works also for Canada and Tamil pilgrims. They are traveling sometimes from 5 days to two or three weeks before reaching Sabarimala, doing a big round and visiting so many temples and visiting parts of Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, and Kerala, and coming back. So there is that dimension of the voyage is a very attractive feature for going back to Sabarimala. There is kind of organic relation with the material practice of pilgrimage.
Business and tourism. Yeah.
Yeah. And which, this is also a connected, related issue, but Sabarimala pilgrims are not yet in the mainstream of religious tourism, like in North India, many people or families from middle class are going to Sabarimala, but it's
on
kind
a
of,
train
they get, they're going to, yeah, there are special train, but
yeah,
it
is,
but
is it the trouble is easy, you cannot... You can simply go to Sabarimala as per the traditional details, of course, after having vratam of...
Yeah, so you cannot go to tourist places,
yeah.
You cannot
go there like a tourist, only after performing this vratam.
Yeah, that's why they cannot go to religious spots while on vratam. And on the way back, it's a new trend. They are starting to visit more tourist places on the way back.
Yeah.
But
that